And now, over the last 20 or 25 years, we've come to understand that before any sensory input is possible in the nervous system, neurons generate spontaneous electrical activity, and that is required for the initial wiring of brain circuitry, and use-driven activity validates and stabilizes that wiring later. This was first also based in the retina, where it was shown that waves of electrical activity crossed the two retinas before photoreceptors even appeared and before the eyes were open. Thus, the conclusion is that the activity was spontaneous and not sensory-driven. Now, spontaneous activity in the form of large-scale waves of electrical activity, in which very large numbers of neurons are active synchronously, has been discovered everywhere in the central nervous system, on the spinal cord, retina, brainstem, midbrain, hippocampus, and as I'll talk about today, in the cerebral cortex. In some experiments we did about 7 or 8 years ago, we used calcium imaging techniques in brain slices at high power, small field of view, imaging between 25 and 100 neurons at the same time. And what you're seeing here is what's called a waterfall plot. Each horizontal line here is a cell, and the vertical axis, the z-axis here, is fluorescence, reporting intracellular calcium, which is a surrogate reporter of electrical activity. And on the x-axis here, time in minutes. And we do this experiment at E16, which is embryonic day 16 in a mouse, 2 days before birth. We see this. We see patterns of spontaneous activity throughout all of these cells, and occasionally 4 or 5 cells that are active in synchrony. But in general, about 95% of the electrical activity is asynchronous in individual neurons. If we do this experiment 2 days later, on the day of birth, we see something completely different, which is that about once every minute, or once every 2 minutes in this case, every cell in our field of view was generating a calcium transient here, increased intracellular calcium due to electrical activity, and they were generating it completely synchronously. And at this stage, the day of birth, 98% of the electrical activity in the cerebral cortex was in this form of highly synchronized activity. And it looks like this when you film it. You'll see this is a small field of view of a brain slice loaded with calcium indicator Flow4. Individual neurons can be seen here in their baseline fluorescence. And as the movie runs, you'll see individual neurons being active, and then that activity interrupted periodically by a large-scale synchronous event. There goes one. It's hard to miss how synchronous they are. It looks in this field of view as if, for example, the bright cells are not participating in that event. That's not correct. That's just your eye not able to detect an increase in fluorescence on a high baseline. In fact, I think more than 95% of all the cells here were participating in those synchronous events. And this film is speeded up by about 10 times. So the question became, for us, is this synchronous activity across the entire brain? Or could it be that, in fact, our small field of view is detecting a wave of activity as it passes across the brain, and it just appears to be synchronous because we don't have the time resolution to detect the wave crossing such a small field of view? And we obtained a couple of years ago one of the newer generation wide field highlight capture microscopes, known as macroscopes, which can take images at very low power, wide field of view, with high enough light capture to record calcium indicator fluorescence accurately. And when we did that, we discovered that, in fact, this, what we called synchronous activity, was actually a propagating wave. So what you're seeing here is a day of birth mouse brain slice. It's cut in the coronal plane, which means like this, parallel to the face. Dorsal is up, ventral is down. You can see the two ventricles here. You can see a little U-shaped corpus callosum here. And these images are fluorescence images from Flow4 loaded cells, and they're what's called pseudocolored. The redder the color is, the higher the fluorescence. and then re-superimposed using a set of MATLAB routines destructively onto the image of the slice so that the fluorescence values here are accurate. That is, they're not contaminated by the camera image of the slice. And it images every 200 milliseconds approximately. Here you see that this activity that we were recording is synchronous, actually starts ventrally and spreads dorsally across all of this hemisphere, and if we went on with this, it would be across the entire brain. We discovered that 100% of these waves, and we've recorded probably 1,500 or more of them at this point, initiate here in the ventral, what's called the piriform cortex. It's three-layered cerebral cortex in the adult. It's involved in olfaction, evolutionarily slightly more primitive than the neocortex, which is up here, the six-layered cortex. The waves occurred in two flavors. Some waves propagated all the way across the hemisphere or the brain. Other waves remain local to this piriform cortex. And I'll talk about the developmental pattern and transmitter dependence of local and propagating waves in just a minute. They look like this. And again, this is speeded up by about tenfold. So you can see actually here the value of calcium, reporting intracellular calcium as a surrogate for electrical activity. We're recording from hundreds of thousands of cells simultaneously here in real time. And by the way, to study developmental progression of these waves, these slices here can be maintained in tissue culture as brain slices for more than 2 weeks, and we can see normal developmental progression of events. So it's a very powerful set of methods here to study what's happening in the embryonic brain. And this is a film of a local wave. And you see that it stops about at the equator between the ventral and dorsal cortex. We also discovered a second pacemaker in the brain for these waves, which is not in the neocortex or the piriform cortex, but in a thalamic structure known as the septal nucleus here. And some waves, as you can see, and these montages actually initiate in this subcortical structure of the septal nucleus. That's very interesting to us. The septal nucleus is famous for experiments done in the 50s by a guy named James Olds. It's known as the pleasure center. He put electrodes in the septal nucleus of awake rats and let them stimulate their own septal nuclei with a little lever. And he starved them, deprived them of water, and took girls away from the boys for weeks. Put them back together in a cage and gave the male rats choice of food, water, or sex, or stimulating the septal nucleus. They stimulate the septal nucleus till they die. So something's really fun about stimulating the septal nucleus. We don't know what. We do know from these films that the cortical pacemaker itself, the one that initiates waves in the piriform cortex, is triggered by the septum. That is, there's not a smooth wave that goes from the septum through the cortex. Here is an average of five waves in an individual slice. The first visible fluorescence for that wave, showing that the initiation zone is here, quite consistently. And here's an average of five waves in the same slice triggered by the septal nucleus. And you can see the activity in a sense hops over to the pacemaker here, which is the same location as this. And then this wave would propagate up through the cortex. So we have two semi-independent pacemakers. We could prove that they were independent pacemakers by surgical experiments where we recorded activity. This is fluorescence on the y-axis in the septum and the cortical pacemaker as a function of time here in an intact slice. And then we took a pair of Vanna scissors, same scissors you're using in lab, and snipped the connection between the two and then continued to record activity. And here we did a cross-correlation plot showing in the control that if you lock septal activity onto an event here in the cortical pacemaker, on average, the cortical pacemaker is preceded by a septal event showing that the septum was triggering. Here you have average high frequencies of activities, but the cross-correlation is basically zero. That is, these two are independent once the connection is cut between them, thus confirming the existence of two pacemakers for activity across the cerebral. Local waves and fully propagating waves are very interesting. Some of the waves, as I said, remain in ventral piriform cortex and they stop near the border of those two structures. It's called the rhinal fissure. Other waves propagate throughout the brain. In fact, The stop point of local waves is astonishingly consistent. Here's an average of the, we used a MATLAB routine here to detect the wave front of activity at the maximum extent of 8 local waves. And you can see that they occupy identical regions of the cortex. That is, those waves stopped at the same exact point at the transition between these two types of structures, piriform and neocortex. And 3 fully propagating waves here, you can see, went all the way to the dorsal midline. That is, they either stop here or they go all the way to this point. No wave ever stops here. Here's another example of 9 waves, the wave front, and 4 fully propagating waves going all the way up here to the dorsal midline. If you plot the frequency histogram here of the angle of maximum extent here, where 0 is this equator between dorsal and ventral, waves, and this is the stop point, the largest extent of propagation of a wave, they stop either there, or at 90 degrees, the dorsal midline, or at 180 degrees, which is over here at the same point, or at 270 degrees, which is all the way around. And they never stop here, here, or here. So there's something special about this checkpoint here. And we hypothesized that there was some checkpoint there that a wave that passed it might slow down at that point. And here we plot the wave front position versus time for 3 local waves and 4 fully propagating waves. They start ventrally down in this region, zip very quickly to the equator, the stop point here, and then pause. Half of the waves in this case stay there and slowly recede. The other half pause. They reduce their velocity of the wavefront by 95% and then zip right up through this dorsal cortex to the dorsal midline where they stop. So there's some special circuitry of propagation which initiates waves here and prevents them from stopping once initiated. There's a checkpoint here that has either the waves stop or slow down. If they pass the checkpoint, they cannot stop here. This circuit promotes propagation, and then another stop point at the dorsal midline. And we don't know the nature of that circuitry at this point. We're still investigating that. For the rest of the experiments that I'm going to show you, we've established a way of summarizing these waves by putting what are called ROIs, regions of interest, in 3 stereotype locations for our analysis. Numbers 1 are left and right septum. 2 we call left and right pacemaker, cortical pacemaker, where waves initiate if they don't initiate here. And 3, left and right dorsal cortex. The activity in 3 indicates the wave has propagated fully. Activity in only 1 and or 2 indicates the wave has stopped at this checkpoint and is a local wave. And we find a very interesting developmental progression of these waves. When they occur overall between the day of birth and about 8 to 10 days after birth. It's only a little over 1 week in the entire life of the animal that these waves occur. On the day of birth, you see a fairly high frequency of events. This is septum, cortical pacemaker, and blue is dorsal, against time here, and these ticks are in minutes. At P0, a lot of activity occurs, on the average about once or twice per minute, in the septum and in the ventral cortical pacemaker, but almost no waves propagate dorsally. They're all local waves. 4 days later, the septum is not as active, the cortical pacemaker is quite active, and quite a large fraction of the waves propagate into the dorsal region. So the propagation pattern has changed. At P7, there aren't many waves, but they all propagate throughout the brain, and by P10, it's gone. And we'll talk about what makes it go away a little bit later. This indicates that the entire propagation pattern and circuitry is changing in the brain over that week, and that the information content of these waves is actually quite complex. That is, dorsal and ventral cortices are receiving different frequencies as a function of stage, and that whatever the waves are doing to help the brain wire, the information content is probably contained in these propagation patterns that are changing very rapidly with development. We have shown that this entire pattern is reproduced in slices that are cultured. So we can compare the slices in culture to slices of the same chronological age taken acutely out of the animal, and the propagation patterns are the same. That's very important because we can actually study these things now in culture and manipulate them much more easily than in intact animals. This is a summary of that data showing Activity, the frequency of activity, waves per minute in the pacemaker and in the dorsal cortex against the stage of development, but B is the actual important part. The fraction of waves that fully propagate through the brain monotonically increases from E18 all the way to 8 days after birth, even though the absolute frequency of the waves is decreasing. So two things are happening at the same time. The waves are being dampened down in frequency, but they're being upregulated in their ability to propagate through the brain. It is well known that the amino acid transmitter GABA, acting on GABA A, ionotropic GABA A receptors, is excitatory early in development. And in the hippocampus, it's been proposed that that excitatory GABA drive is what causes this kind of activity. So we decided to test that with the blocker of the GABA A receptor, picrotoxin. And the answer turned out to be yes and no. Early in development, P0, P1, when the waves are mostly local and occurring at high frequency, application of the GABA-A blocker picrotoxin blocks waves. Again, this is a fluorescence record in a region of the brain, the ventral pacemaker as a function of time. At P12, though, when the waves have gone away, picrotoxin stimulates them. This suggests that GABA is excitatory early in development for this activity because blocking the receptor blocks the activity, but it makes a transition to inhibitory later and may in fact be shutting off the waves, and then blocking the inhibitory effect of GABA at later stages induces waves. And we plotted the fraction of the picrotoxin block in this graph as a function of stage. This is activity in picrotoxin divided by control. So 1 means picrotoxin does nothing. Less than 1 means it inhibits the waves. Greater than 1, it stimulates. And here you can see a gradual shift in picrotoxin effect from inhibitory to stimulatory, implying that GABA is making a gradual transition here from excitatory to inhibitory, which is as expected from previous data on GABA effects. If not GABA, who? Right, who's stimulating the waves out here, which exist if GABA is inhibitory? We tested the involvement of AMPA-type glutamate receptors with the blockers CNQX, and we got just the opposite result. At early stages, CNQX, although it reduces the amplitude of calcium transients, indicating that glutamatergic neurons are participating in the waves, it does not change the frequency of waves, indicating that it's not involved in pacemaker activity. At later stages, P8, CNQX blocks entirely, suggesting that as GABA becomes inhibitory and can't initiate waves, the function is taken over by glutamate, and it, at later stages, initiates waves. And here's the similar plot of CNQX effect. CNQX is always inhibitory because AMPA-type glutamate receptors are never inhibitory. Blocking them always inhibits waves, but the inhibition is actually weak early and complete late. So although the waves continue over a long period of development, the nature of the pacemaker switches. The location doesn't switch, but the neurons in that location that initiate waves change from the GABA neurons to the glutamate neurons. It's probably a very nice evolutionary adaptation to the problem that faced by the cortex, which is to carry out the developmental effects of activity, these waves had to occur over a long period of time. During that period of time, the transmitter GABA becomes inhibitory, so it cannot serve the pacemaker function. So somehow, you hand off the pacemaking function to glutamatergic neurons halfway through the process, and this ensures that the waves continue past the developmental stage at which GABA becomes inhibitory. Well, as I showed you before, waves early in development tend to be local in the ventral cortex, and later they tend to be fully propagated. That correlates quite well with early local waves being during the time when GABA is initiating waves, and the fully propagating waves occur later when glutamate is initiating. So is it possible that we have two different types of waves, GABA initiated that don't propagate dorsally, and glutamate initiated that do? And the answer is yes, that is true. If you apply picrotoxin at intermediate stages, let's say P4 to P5, when you have both transmitters involved and both types of waves occurring, you find here a combination of local waves. See, the frequency in the pacemaker is much higher than the frequency dorsally. So these waves that don't appear here are local, and the few that do appear dorsally are fully propagating. If you block GABA-A receptors with piperoxicin, you selectively knock out the local waves, but you don't significantly change the frequency of the fully propagating waves. Conversely, if you have the same kind of recording here in the presence of an AMPA blocker CNQX, it selectively eliminates the fully propagating dorsal waves but leaves intact the waves in the pacemaker. And here's a histogram of the results showing that for local waves, CNQX does not block much, right? This is drug over control, so a high number means lack of block. And piperoxicin blocks significantly. For fully propagating waves, piperoxicin doesn't block much, but CNQX does. So it indicates that the swap of transmitter pacemaker functions from GABAergic to glutamatergic neurons, that the glutamatergic waves tend to propagate, that the glutamate circuitry in the brain is consistent with getting a wave dorsally propagating and the GABAergic circuitry isn't. This also shows that the two pacemakers can coexist at the same time at intermediate stages, each initiating its own type of wave. And what we're trying to do now is to use extremely high-speed, high-sensitivity cameras to film the initiation of waves at single-cell level at very high speeds. Normally, calcium imaging has been limited to speeds of, you know, 2 to 8 or 2 to 10 frames per second. New generation cameras now can run up to 150 frames per second, so we should get very high temporal resolution single-cell films in the next couple of months, asking at these stages when we propose two different pacemakers, are they in slightly different locations, or do they involve slightly different identified cell types? If you do immunocytochemical staining for the presence of GABAergic neurons, they're stained by detecting the synthetic enzyme GAD, you find that the GABAergic neurons are, in fact, localized preferentially at early stages ventrally, right where the pacemaker is, confirming the piperoxicin data. And in fact, you can see here faintly the staining for GAD stopping at this boundary between the piriform ventral and dorsal cortex. This is a thick slice, 300 micron slice. It's hard to do high-level immunocytochemistry on it, but the advantage was we had previously imaged this slice for waves. And here's the maximum extent of the wave, one of the waves in the slice, lining up absolutely perfectly on the border of where the GABAergic neuron density declines. So we're fairly confident at this point that the GABAergic population is mediating these local waves at early stages. It's an interesting population, the inhibitory interneurons in the cortex. The pyramidal cells, the excitatory neurons of the cortex, are born, we can't see it here very well, next to the ventricles in a stem cell population called the ventricular zone. They migrate radially out here into the cortex. The GABAergic neurons are actually born in a subcortical structure called the ganglionic eminence and some in the septum here, and they migrate ventrally, tangentially, around the cortex like this in this direction to reach their final locations. So many of these GABAergic neurons are here because they're on the way through. They're migrating. And I'll come in a minute to the question of whether a migratory neuron, which has not started making synaptic connections, could actually initiate an electrical wave. This whole pattern of activity is only present for a week. It terminates at about P8 to P10. How? We asked the question of whether the termination of this activity was caused by this activity. That is, was it self-terminating? It would be a great engineering solution to the problem of variability. If you had different embryos that had slightly different frequencies of activity, the low frequency embryos would have to have the activity extend over a longer period of time to carry out the developmental effects. How do you know when to stop the activity? Well, the best way to do it would be putting a feedback loop in whereby activity stops itself. It's like an internal monitor. I've done my job, now I can quit. Well, we asked that question by taking slices and culturing them for a week during the period of activity, either in normal medium or tetrodotoxin, to block activity. A control slice at P12 that's been raised in culture has no activity here. This is, you know, four regions of the brain, fluorescence against time. There are no events here. That's normal. Activity is terminated. But a slice that had been cultured in tetrodotoxin during the period of the waves, and then the tetrodotoxin is removed, is generating activity like crazy. And in fact, we've not been able to culture these long enough to show the termination of activity. This indicates that you have to have spontaneous activity in the brain in order to stop having spontaneous activity in the brain. That is, it's in the feedback loop. How? Well, is it possible that the emergence of GABA as an inhibitory transmitter is what stops activity? That is, GABA goes from excitatory to neutral, the reversal potential right near threshold. By that point, glutamatergic neurons have taken over pace-making activity. At some point, you'd predict that GABA becomes inhibitory enough to shut down the glutamate neuron pacemaker. So is it possible what activity is doing here in some way is preventing GABA from becoming inhibitory? Well, one way that could happen, we know how GABA becomes an inhibitory transmitter. During development of the brain, there is a developmental induction of the gene for an outwardly directed chloride pump called the KCC2 chloride pump that exports chloride, lowers intracellular chloride concentration. That makes the GABA reversal potential more negative. That's what makes GABA inhibitory. Is it possible that blocking sodium channels, that is blocking spontaneous activity, during the period of activity prevents that chloride pump from reducing intracellular chloride? To test this, we used a technique known as the gramicidin perforated patch, whole cell plant technique. You record from cells without disrupting the normal intracellular chloride concentration. You apply a GABA agonist, muscimol, to the cell, and you measure the reversal potential as a surrogate for the chloride clearance potential, because the GABA-A channel is a chloride channel. And what you find here is that the reversal potential at late stages of development, at P8 or P10, is quite negative here, around minus 60, indicating that GABA has become an inhibitory transmitter. The threshold of these cells is about minus 35 to minus 40 millivolts. In the presence, in slices which had previously had their activity blocked with tetrodotoxin, the GABA reversal potential is significantly more positive, indicating that the transition of GABA to an inhibitory transmitter has been disrupted. To test that was caused by the KCC2 chloride pump, which transports potassium out of the cell and uses the energy derived from that movement to move the chloride, we loaded the cells, we took cesium out of the cytoplasm and, sorry, took potassium out of the cytoplasm and loaded the cells with cesium, which is not transported by the pump. And after 3 or 4 minutes of recording, this reversal potential here coasted to this reversal potential, indicating that direct block of the KCC2 chloride pump can prevent or reverse the lowering of intracellular chloride. And so from these data, we conclude that one of the functions of spontaneous activity is to trigger the induction of the KCC2 outwardly directed chloride pump during development. That pumps chloride, lowers intracellular chloride, makes the GABA reversal potential more negative, converts GABA to an inhibitory transmitter, shuts off activity. And we believe that's the feedback loop that controls the developmental window of time for the spontaneous activity. More recently, we've been involved in a collaborative project with Professor Albert Folch in bioengineering to develop a new method of recording from these slices electrically. It's nice to use calcium signals as a surrogate for electrical activity, but they're not perfect. It is quite possible to block calcium entry into cells during activity without blocking the activity. The problem is that multi-electrode extracellular recording to record propagation is not normally compatible optically with high-resolution imaging. It's very difficult to do, but we wanted to be able to do both. So working with Albert, we developed a microfluidic recording device. This device is several layers of a substance called PDMS. You know it in lab as Silgard, very transparent elastomer. And with photolithographic techniques, we have drilled into the PDMS substrate 50 micron holes called apertures that come up through the surface. And each of those is linked into a micro channel here, which carries fluid. And the apertures, and through via the channels here, are connected to large wells. And you can put amplifier connections into those wells, and you can record extracellularly from this 12 aperture array. And this is what it looks like in the dish. The brain slice is right there in the middle. And these are the electrical connections here And here's the sites of the 12 recording apertures. This device is fully transparent and allows us to actually do calcium imaging through the recording device while electrically recording at the same time. And this is one example of a propagating wave of activity. You see the apertures are arranged so that number 4 in red here is down near our ventral pacemaker. You can see the leads coming off here. And you can see at this point, number 4 initiated a wave, and you could record the propagation of that wave over the course of 100 or 200 milliseconds into the dorsal cortex. The first thing we ask, because this is a microfluidic device with an aperture filled with saline, we don't have to just record, we can stimulate. We can stimulate electrically, we can stimulate with transmitters. So we used an auto-detection routine here in MATLAB to find the point of initiation, which turned out to be aperture 4. And then a couple minutes later, we delivered a stimulus to aperture 4 to ask whether we could artificially activate the pacemaker. And there we got our propagating wave that's basically identical to the spontaneous wave. So we actually not only can record, but we can have control of these events by stimulating them. And we're in the process right now in a project done by a second year student in the undergraduate neurobiology major at the University of Washington, to ask whether the sensitivity to stimulation is spatially different. That is, the non-pacemaker region up here, could it initiate waves if it were stimulated or not? We don't know the answer to that yet. Here we show an imaging record. I'll show you some more in a few minutes. This is an outline of the aperture. It's transparent, you can't see it. And a brief electrical stimulation here of about less than a millisecond causes a fluorescence increase, and these little dots are single cells. We're imaging at single cell resolution through this device. Causes a very local calcium wave that slowly dissipates over about 30 seconds. Wide-scale imaging can be done at the same time we record, and it yields some of the differences between electrical and optically measured activity. Here are the electrical leads here showing a wave initiating at number 3 and propagating dorsally. And at each of the red lines here, we show an optical image of the slice with a calcium indicator in it. And you can see here's the wave propagating ventrally to dorsally in that case. Here at 2 and 10 seconds, which is off this scale, the electrical wave is gone in 200 to 300 milliseconds. The calcium signal is still dissipating. So a much longer duration signal than the electrical event in the individual cells. And this is just an expanded version, again, not expanded enough for my taste, but I didn't make a figure. Showing these little dots, we can resolve the single cell activity imaging through this device. And this is a film. This is made by a postdoc in the lab, Adina Scott, who went to great trouble to make this film. When you see it roll, you'll see how hard it is. The electrical recording here from 9 extracellular sites is going to scroll by, and the red line indicates the time sync here on the imaging from the same slice. So you'll see the correlation between the two. It takes a minute to go by, but it's kind of fun. You see one event appeared as a calcium signal ventrally. There's an artifact. See, there's a local event here in the pacemaker. Another little tiny local event here. We hadn't been detecting these very well before. These are pacemaker-only events. A couple attempts here to stimulate that were unsuccessful. And then someday, a fully propagating event will initiate here and come through the cortex. You'll see it as an electrical event. There we go. Okay. So this, and then there's a little secondary pacemaker. So this indicates that we do have the ability to time sync optical and electrical recordings, which really opens up a lot more questions that we can ask. Now what we really want to do is ask, are GABAergic neurons serving as a pacemaker? We'd like to prove that at the single cell level by recording from them and figuring out what makes them a pacemaker. And also, is there a difference between GABAergic neurons that are migrating and ones that have landed? They move through this pacemaker region. Some of them stay there. They become the intrinsic inhibitory neurons of the ventral piriform cortex. Others are just in transit on their way through. Is it possible to detect the presence in a living tissue of those neurons and their migratory history while at the same time recording from them. And so that's the next question we're asking. This is a picture of the dorsal, a region of dorsal cortex here from a genetically engineered mouse that has green fluorescent protein linked onto the synthetic enzyme for GABA. And this is a live slice, and the fluorescent neurons here are the inhibitory neurons. They're about 50% of what's there. You can see that we actually have quite good resolution of these neurons for the purpose of recording from them from a known GABAergic neuron. Okay. Now the question is, can we know anything about their migratory history? And a graduate student and a neurobiology undergraduate student in the lab decided to try something that I thought was just plain stupid and a waste of money and time, which is to take this slice, keep it warm and oxygenated for 10 hours, put it in the spinning disk confocal microscope, and film it, and ask, can you see live, in a brain slice, neuronal migration? And, yeah.
No, you couldn't. I would show you the picture. It didn't work.
This will go by, and I'll repeat it a couple of times. What you'll see here is live developmental neuronal migration, and you'll see two types of migratory pathways if you look. Vertical, this way. This indicates GABAergic neurons that have quit their tangential pathway of migration and are moving up and down in the cortex to find their target location. And you'll see others that are more horizontally migrating, which indicates neurons, GABAergic neurons in transit to other locations in the cortex. And this is, the film is compressed, it's 10 hours long in real time, and it's you'll know the compression, the full length film would be 10 hours. And you can't miss it. There's neuronal migration live. Is that it? I guess I should have put it on loop. We'll run it a couple times to see. So you can see, for example, this neuron, right where the mouse pointer is oriented horizontally. The processors are coming out this way, and it's moving horizontally. Other neurons are oriented vertically and moving vertically. It's actually, if you're interested in neuronal migration disorders in pediatric neurology, I mean, this is a great way to study the genesis of those disorders. So the experiment we're doing now, actually, is to take these mice, and we're re-engineering them for a technical reason. It turns out the wavelength of GFP interferes with the wavelength of the calcium indicator dye. That's the brightest one that we have to use. So we're breeding these mice with a non-GFP marker called TD tomato, which is a red marker, so we can image calcium in the cells at the same time. At that point, we'll be able to take a preparation like this, film it for an hour or so, identify neurons by type, that is, they're GABAergic. They'll be loaded with a calcium indicator. We'll know their migratory history, which way they're going, where they are, and then we'll be able to image calcium versus time here during spontaneous activity, and at the same time, do direct electrical recordings from them. And we think with a combination of those techniques, we'll be able to identify what makes a pacemaker. And the final experiment we're attempting in the next couple of weeks is to go into the pacemaker region and identify individual GABAergic neurons, record from them, and then stimulate them and ask, can a single neuron initiate a wave? That is, from our microfluidic device experiments, we know that stimulus delivered over an aperture of only 50 microns, which is about only twice the diameter of a cell, can initiate a full wave. That might be stimulating 5 cells, 10 cells, we don't know. Actually, that's a number we're getting now by stimulating cells in the presence of a cocktail of blockers of synaptic transmission to ask how many cells do we directly stimulate with that device. I think the answer will be 5 to 10. The next question is, can we come to one of these cells whose migratory history indicates that it's mature and has landed in the cortex, stimulate a single cell and initiate a propagating wave over the several hundred thousand cells of the wave of the cortex, and then in voltage clamp ask what's special about that cell? Does it have different types of currents than its non-pacemaker neighbors? And those are the types of questions we're asking in the next, I would like to say a few months, but it will be a few years. Conclusions, waves are initiated by GABAergic neurons at early stages, and they remain local to the piriform or ventral cortex, by glutamatergic neurons at later stages, and they tend to propagate. Why? How does the passing off of the pacemaker function occur? We're proposing that the activity initiated by GABA actually induces the insertion of AMPA receptors in nearby cells and turns them into pacemakers, and I think the experiment for that is, is a pretty obvious one. It involves simple form of learning in the developmental context. It's a project that will be going on in the lab in the next several months. Activity terminates itself by triggering the export of chloride ions and causing GABA inhibition to emerge, and simultaneous recordings and imaging of labeled GAD-GFP or tomato neurons may elucidate the mechanism and participation of GABAergic neurons in spontaneous activity. I didn't do this work myself, some of myself. A large number of people over the last 5 years have participated. I'd just like to identify for you the students who were either currently in or formerly in the undergraduate neurobiology major, just so you have an idea. Matt, Sammy, Sarah, Jay, Curtis, Dan, Emily, Jonathan, Luke, Mitra, Zeke, Keiko, Annie, and Audrey were all neurobiology majors. Helga Gleiss and Christine Cole pioneered. They came on a internship from the Technical University of Munich for a master's degree and pioneered the high-speed imaging. Curtis was a neurobiology student, now a PhD student in the lab. Adina Scott is a postdoc whose specialty is electrical engineering, and she's spearheading the project on the microfluidic recording device. Heather Barnett is an MD PhD student currently in the lab who's working on computational properties of individual pacemakers. And then none of that microfluidic work would be done without the collaboration of Albert Folsch, professor in bioengineering. Thank you, and we have time for questions. So I truncated by 5 minutes, so the standard seminar would be 50 minutes plus 10 or 15 minutes for questions. It's not quite compatible with class time, so I truncated by 5 minutes to give people a chance to ask questions. Yeah. Absolutely. It does sound like it should cause problems. One of the tools we have now, one hypothesis is that the overall frequency is set because once a wave is initiated, no matter by which pacemaker, the ventral cortex is refractory. Okay? That's very hard to test without being able to stimulate. Now we have the ability to directly stimulate in the ventral cortex, and one of the projects going on over the next couple months is to measure the refractory period for waves. So to push the frequency of direct stimulation to see how fast it can go, and second is to have the existence of a spontaneous wave be detected and trigger a stimulation at different times after that task. Does a spontaneous wave have a different refractory period than a stimulated wave? I agree, it seems like a stupid way to do things, but then again, mice have been around for a long time, so something's right. But we don't know how they interact. That's something we're working on.
For today, you said that there can be increased numbers of AMPA receptors.
Yeah, there's a process that's known in what's called long-term potentiation, or in simple form of learning. It's got the wonderful name of amplification, which is that when a synapse, the presynaptic and postsynaptic partners, are synchronously active, it tends to cause the insertion of AMPA receptors into the postsynaptic membrane and increase the strength of the synapse. Normally, that's thought of as a learning mechanism. You use the synapse, it gets stronger. One of the great problems in development is most synapses in the cortex early in development are NMDA receptor mediated only, the glutamatergic synapses. They're called silent, right? There's nothing else to depolarize the cell. If you can't have the synapse work, how do you ever start that process going? Well, it turns out if you have a pacemaker that runs all of the neurons synchronously, it fools the coincidence detector into thinking that the synapses work because both partners are active at the same time, and then we think that might cause the insertion of the receptors. But that's just a hypothesis right now, but a testable one, right? You should be able to block GABAergic activity early and show that you do not get the emergence of the glutamatergic pacemaker. A simple experiment, just waiting to be done. See. Do I know you?
The migrating cells. I was kind of curious. Do you know what they're interacting with and causing a migration? If there's any analogy to like white blood cell migration?
No one really knows. We know that we know they have specific migratory pathways. We know that they can release GABA while they're migrating. But how they detect where they're going, we don't know yet. One handle we have, we also have a collaboration with Bob Hefner at Children's Research Institute, and he's got knockout mice for different subtypes of the glutamate neurons. And if we can knock those out, in fact, we're doing that right now, knock those out and then film the migration, we can ask how does GABAergic neuron migration depend on different glutamatergic neuron subtype presence. But no one knows yet. I mean, the hypothesis we have that's supported by work in culture is that GABAergic neurons, when they're migrating, don't participate in these waves. And we have some evidence that that's true. They begin to participate when they start to find their final location, and that that participation is the stop signal. That's Curtis's thesis work. We just don't have the answer. It's a very, very hard experiment.
Tell him to work harder.
I'll tell him to work harder, yeah.
I have two questions. When you put the new stimulation ability, can you stimulate in between your stop points and get initiation of a wave that wouldn't naturally be?
You mean kind of goose up the stop point and get a wave to go through?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we can. We haven't done it yet. It's a great experiment. That the ability to do all those things at once really raises a lot of possibilities, and we are just going on those experiments. And it's just it's a lot of work, and it requires microscopy, and we only have so many microscopes. So it's kind of, we're a little bit limited by time on the various microscopes.
Is there a correlation between the two hemispheres? In the very beginning, it looked like they were pretty synchronous, actually.
They can be synchronous because a wave propagates around. They can be synchronous because the pacemakers are triggered by the septum at the same time and it goes like this, or they can be independent. You can cut them apart and have them running independently. But yeah, the statistics are that they're not correlated very well because of that.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, typically what the first 10 days
Their eyes are closed. They are inactive / sleeping about 80% of the time. There's some evidence this activity occurs, is stopped during the waking period. They're navigating to mom's milk supply by smell, which is interesting because this is the olfactory cortex, and the mother is singing to them at very high pitch, which we can't hear, to bring them, right? The problem is that one of the mice are not really good moms, right? Good moms don't eat their children. And mice do if anything disrupts them. So that what we would love to be able to do is put a little radio frequency transmitter EEG on the scalp of a mouse, right? There's no skull. The skull is, at this stage, about the consistency of saran wrap. You can see right through the thing. If we could put a micro EEG electrode, we can measure these waves live. But as soon as you touch that mouse, the mom kills it. And if you take it away from the mom, it dies pretty quickly. So we're very limited in this sort of slightly invasive behavioral work. I mean, we were going to try it. But yeah, what they're doing is eating, basically. Eating a very high-fat diet, and they're in interesting metabolic ketosis for the first 10 days. They open their eyes not till 20 days. So they hear smell, but don't see.
Do you consider trying a different animal in which that doesn't occur, like in the first stages of birth?
Yeah. The trouble is we could do a lot with a different animal, but mice have just fabulous background of genetics that we can use. I mean, we can have these GFPs are just, a ferret is a classical preparation for that because of its developmental profile is much different from this, but there are not a lot of transgenic ferrets. I mean, we just don't have access to the kind of tools. So we may go there if we really need to, but we haven't saturated what we can do on mice. And frankly, I don't want to do the paper. It's hard enough with a mouse. Okay, one more question.
So with the synchronous activity forming lots of synapses by that long-term potentiation, could this be a method by which the brain overmakes neurons and synapses and then trims them down later?
Yeah, we think that there's evidence in retina and lateral geniculate that the activity is a method of strengthening synapses developmentally and then trimming them down to their topographic locations. If you think of a wave, these neurons are sending axons all over the place, down into the base of the brain. How does the postsynaptic target know which the location of the axon that it's seeing in this bundle of axons? Well, if a wave is propagating repeatedly, two axons that are active within a few milliseconds come from two cell bodies next to each other. Ones that are active further apart come from distant cell bodies. Waves, in principle, carry the information content of the XY coordinate of the cell in the brain to its downstream targets. That's a very likely idea. We have an undergraduate in the lab developed a special slicing protocol at a double weird angle that includes cortex and thalamus and includes all the somatosensory called the vibrissa circuits, the circuits from the whiskers. So all those connections are intact, and so now we're looking at the bounce back of activity between the two to try to test that. And again, he's been able to culture those slices. Okay, I know, we're late. I just think about how much you've learned in 9 weeks.
Okay.
You could understand the seminar, right?
You can come.